Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon on Faith Radio. And there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Well, good afternoon. Good Friday afternoon. Welcome to the show. I'm Joe Bender. It's great to have you here this afternoon. Well, you know, it's the start of a new season almost. It feels like fall today, so I'm just saying it's kind of starting a new season. I see students running around campus, which means new things are starting for them. And while it's not January, fall is often a really great time to start something new. It's a great time for me to kind of sit and reflect what's been going on over the year, what I'd like to see happen during this year. It's a wonderful time for parents who've had kids home all summer to finally be able to sit down and think about maybe setting some goals. And whether it's in my work life or in relationships, or maybe it has something to do with spiritual growth, whatever it is, this seems to be a good chance to say, okay, here's what's on my list this year. Maybe you have that happen to you as well. Or maybe you have the same things you think about every fall and wonder why you haven't done them yet, which happens sometimes as well. Well, then you are really going to enjoy what we are going to discuss today, and you're really going to enjoy my guest today. He can help. He can help give a little spark to those goals of change that you may think you want but haven't quite been able to start yet. In fact, he says that whether change is personal or whether it's more broad, partnering with God to change our world or change ourselves can happen one small risk at a time. So we're going to talk about what that means, and hopefully that will give you an opportunity to start that change that you've been thinking about in your life as well. My guest today is Jason Jaggard. He's the CEO and founder of Spark Good, a company passionate about unleashing creative potential in individuals and organizations. He's the creator of Spark Groups, which is an experience that has set thousands of people on a new course in life. Before starting Spark Good, Jason worked on staff at Mosaic, a community of faith in Los Angeles. He also teaches at Pepperdine University and speaks to a wide variety of audiences across the country. In fact, is coming to University of Northwestern next month for a great conference we have here, and we'll talk about that in a little bit as well. Welcome, Jason.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, it's great to have you here. I love the concept that you've created here, that we need this spark in order to actually get something moving. How did you come to understand this, and how did you come to want to share it with other people?
This journey around my company and really the whole idea around risk is a conversation that I created mostly for myself originally. I'm one of those people who loves to absorb information. I'm always reading books. I'm listening to podcasts. I'm listening to radio shows like yours. I love going to conferences, like the conference coming up. You know, and now, of course, I get to speak at conferences, and that's a whole other experience. But whether it's the Willow Creek Leadership Summit or like the Chick-fil-A Catalyst, you know, the Catalyst podcast, everything. Like, I just loved absorbing information. And there came a time for me when I realized that this huge gap between the amount of information I knew and the amount of information that I lived. And most people probably can experience something like that, you know, especially like with biblical literacy. A lot of people have way more Bible verses in their heads than they do in their hands and in their lives. And so this started to actually concern me, not necessarily like that I was a bad person, not necessarily that, you know, that somehow something was, quote, wrong, but I felt like I was missing out. Like, why is it that I knew so much but lived so smallly? And so that started a journey for me, really, when I moved to Los Angeles to be a part of Mosaic and experienced this culture that had a huge value for risk-taking. In fact, it was at Mosaic that I learned that if you ask most people to think of like spiritual disciplines, like if right now all your listeners would say, hey, what are the list of spiritual disciplines? Usually people come up with a list of like prayer, fasting, maybe going to church. You know, if you're a pastor, you're going to throw tithing in there. Like, there's all sorts of ways to have spiritual practices. But what almost no one ever says when you ask the question, what are some spiritual disciplines? Very, very, very few people ever say the word risk. And it was St. Augustine who said that risk is the chief of all virtues because it is through risk that all virtue flows. And so it was in that context that I started exploring risk as a spiritual discipline, and that really launched everything there for me.
So how do you put the word risk into spiritual disciplines? Because it seems like a spiritual discipline is something that is very measured, and yet a risk is something like, I'm going to discipline. This isn't discipline. I'm just going to jump off the edge here. How do you explain the dichotomy between those two?
Yeah, that's fantastic. And so in my work, so a lot of what I do these days is executive coaching. And what we do is we listen, when we work with our clients, we're listening to false dichotomies. And that's a perfect example. You know, so this idea that a risk is somehow impulsive versus a discipline, which is the discipline, right? And in our experience with all of our clients, what we realize is that every risk is always intentional. No one's ever taken a risk on accident. You know, every risk is a choice, really. It's a choice on purpose. And so if it's done on purpose, that means it can become a ritual. That means it can become a habit. And the reality is, Joe, that if you ask people to think about the most powerful times in their lives, if you ask people to think about the most meaningful times in their lives, the most emotionally rich times of their lives, the place where they grew the most spiritually, the times when they became the kinds of people that they long to be, what I know, I don't have to know anything about them, what I know for a fact is that there was a risk that catalyzed that moment, whether it was leaning in for a first kiss, whether it was starting a company, or whether it was your decision to follow Jesus, or whether it was a moment when you got married or decided to have kids. Like, those moments are the moments that define our lives, and they are always associated with risk. So with our company, the question we ask is, well, why, instead of risk being a glimpse of life, why can't it become a rhythm of life? How do we start putting that into practice in our lives rhythmically, the same way that we do with everything else that matters to us?
Hmm. And so as you started to encourage other people to take these risks and your company began to form, how were you inspired to keep building on what you started?
There's different types of risks, and usually we only think of the first kind. So usually when we think of risk, we think of starting something. But sometimes the greatest risk is sustaining something. Right, you know, so I know people who, of course, taking a risk is starting a relationship, but I know lots of married people where it's a risk to continue the relationship. And that was a process for me, really. And it's the last few years. I mean, anytime anyone's tried to build anything, there's that temptation when you go through the dip, and it's hard and it's not fun anymore. I mean, the reality is when you start something new, there's a dopamine hit in your brain. It creates all this excitement. It creates all this thrill. That's really we think it's the hardest part. Like they say, like, starting something is the hardest part. That's not the hardest part. Starting things is fun. The hardest part is sustaining something, building something, seeing it through. In fact, if I can, Joe, I just one of my buddies, his name is Dr. Marcus Goody Goodlow. He's got a book coming out. So this is a shameless plug for him. He's got a book coming out called Kingmakers, and he writes about the never-before-told leadership exploits of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. with athletes and entertainers. So most people know about Dr. King's leadership, but they don't know that an integral part of the civil rights movement was him working with athletes and entertainers in a way that no one had ever done before in history. It's really, really fascinating. And one of the stories he tells is the I Have a Dream speech. And the I Have a Dream speech, most people don't realize, was never supposed, like, the I Have a Dream portion of his speech was never supposed to be in the original talk, like the staff writers. And more than that, he had given that talk three times. Dr. King had given that part of the speech, that I Have a Dream part, he'd given it three times in Chicago, I think in Atlanta and someplace else in the previous year, and it never landed. Like, it wasn't a good bit, like, as a communicator, like, it didn't work. And so he's on stage and he's giving his talk on the Lincoln Memorial, on the Cecil Lincoln Memorial, and it's not working. Like, if you watch his talk, it wasn't landing the way that he hoped that it would. And then Mahalia Jackson is behind him and says, "Tell him about the dream, Martin." And he kind of ignores her. You know, he, like, waves his hand off and he keeps going. And she says again, "Tell him about the dream, Martin." And then you see Dr. King shift and you see him put his notes away. And then he downshifts into the I Have a Dream speech, which is something that, again, his speechwriters are telling him not to do. And when he did, his speechwriters rolled their eyes. And then one guy said, "Oh, we're about to have some church." And then, of course, Dr. King opened up a can of oratorical awesomeness and the rest is history. And the reason why I tell that story is because it would have been easy for Dr. King to give something new. It would have been easy for Dr. King to just try to say something fresh and to say something that was, new, and to take a risk and to spark something new. But the spark came from the thing that was old. The spark came from the thing that was there that was waiting to come alive. The spark came from him being faithful to material that he knew was right. It just hadn't ripened yet. And I think that's the greatest challenge. And that's been the greatest challenge for me in my own life, and just about every area of my life, not starting something, but sustaining it.
Well, and it does seem that when we think about becoming successful at something, whether it's starting a company, starting a family, project, whatever it is that we're going to do, we think about, well, who's gone before us, where we can measure results, where we can put together a plan, where we can create an outline, make a business plan, and then follow that to a T. And those steps seem to be encouraged that we want to follow that. And yet, if you think about even if you look through the Gospels and think about what Jesus was asking his disciples to do, and even those who went on and founded the early church through Acts, all of those things that they were doing did not have a measured goal in mind. They had a goal, but they did not have a measured plan in mind. And yet somehow it worked. But I can't imagine that they were like, what, we're supposed to do that? No. Well, we can't do that. Well, how about if we try this? I imagine those conversations taking place like, there's no way this will work. Well, let's do it anyway.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And New Testament spirituality is a great benchmark for this kind of vibrant life that Jesus is calling us into. They didn't have goals necessarily, but what they did have, they had this vision that was so much bigger than themselves. And what I admire about the early followers of Jesus is they had the audacity to believe that God wanted to change the course of human history through their choices. And honestly, that's something that is so hard to hold on to in modern-day spirituality. So much of modern spirituality is about safety and security and, you know, and a lot of beautiful biblical metaphors, like God is your shepherd, you know, so he'll take care of you, those types of ideas. But what most people don't understand is the biblical shepherd wasn't just someone who, like, took care of you and petted you or whatever. He was someone who led you into places that you were too scared to go on your own. And that comes back to the idea of risk. To be a follower of Jesus is to make risk the center of your spirituality, whether it's a risk to talk to your neighbor about their faith, whether it's a risk to serve your spouse in some new way, whether it's a risk to change your major, whether it's a risk to be faithful to the thing that God has given you in your heart and step into the unknown or to create things. Like, that is where life is found with God.
Why don't people generally take more risks? What seems to be the biggest hang-up?
Yeah, well, you know, I get asked that question a lot, and the first answer to that question is super common sense, and then there's a second answer that's a little less common sense. So the first answer is they're scared. That's the reason why we don't do anything. But the insidious nature of it is we tend to hide our fear with something worse, which is called busyness. Yeah, so that's really the issue is fear. But we would never say, most people don't say, the reason why I'm not doing this is because I'm scared. Very few of my clients, when I ask them, you know, we get on a call and they say, hey, this is how much our company is going to do in revenue this year. And I say, well, why aren't you doing 50% more? They almost never say, well, because I'm scared. But that's always why it is. It's always the reason why we don't have better marriages is because we're scared. The reason why we're not making more money is because we're scared. The reason why we don't have a more dynamic, vibrant relationship with God is because we're scared. Which is why the scriptures talk so much about fear. In fact, it says that perfect love casts out fear. And the more you connect to the love of God, the less fear you have. And the reason why that's important isn't just so that you won't be afraid, as if it's like taking a pill. Okay, if I take the pill of love, I won't be scared. But there's a broader conversation that if I embrace love, then I'm fearless to go do things that only fearless people can do. And that's the other part of that, Joe, just real quick, is we like being scared. We love it. Being scared gives us excuses. Being scared helps us to stay a victim. Being scared helps people lower their expectations of us. There's all sorts of benefits to being scared, and it's only until we start looking at fear as it really is that we're able to throw it off and to step into things that are more beautiful.
Well, I'm talking to Jason Jagard today. He's written a book called Spark, Transform Your World, One Small Risk at a Time. We're going to talk a little bit more about risk and how to get that spark, how to get past those fears that we might have to get something new started. If you're listening and you think, hey, this sounds super interesting to me, I'd like to learn a little bit more about it. Well, we do have a handful of books to give away that Jason and his publisher have provided for us. You can give us a call at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. And if you have a leader, someone you know in your life who leads people, this would just be a great gift for them as well. And we also have a conference to talk about. I'll bring that up a little bit more after the break so we can get you maybe some tickets to that as well. And you can see Jason live. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith. good afternoon. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender, and today talking to Jason Jaggard, who's CEO and founder of Spark Good. It's a company that's passionate about unleashing creative potential in individuals and organizations, and it applies to our spiritual life as well. Jason's been talking about taking risk and how important that is to seeing change, and that's part of a conference that we have here at University of Northwestern in September. And the reason I'm telling you about it is because we are going to be giving away tickets for this conference. You could get a ticket and bring three of your friends if you want to come too, right? Three of your friends, four
yeah,
total.
Three plus one,
you'd be the one. Yes, we're giving away packages of tickets, and I will tell you a little bit more about that. The conference is called Fuel. It's September 19th on the University of Northwestern campus in St. Paul. The conference is open to anyone who's seeking godly leadership and development. It features some great speakers like Jason and several others as well. You can learn more about it if you go to our website at myfaithradio.com and click on the Connecting Faith show page, and that's how you can enter to win those tickets. So if you're interested, it's a great conference. I've been there before, and would love to see you there if you live anywhere near the Twin Cities. Well, Jason, this conference Fuel, of course, brings up a lot of different issues that we may have in ministry and in leadership. What's the biggest challenge that you find leaders have when they're talking about, I just can't get my congregation to what, or I just can't get my small group to what? What's the biggest challenge that you hear?
Can I say there's two challenges?
Yes, you can say two. Say three if you want.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, so I mean, the short answer is you really have to get in front of every leader. Every leader has a custom tailored problem. There's going to be generalities that begin to emerge. And one is almost every leader I know thinks that they do vision really well. If you were to say, hey, how do you do like vision casting for your company? How do you do a vision casting for your church? And I rarely do I meet a pastor or a leader who says, I'm really bad at that. And almost every pastor or leader I've ever worked with is really bad at that. They just really are not good at it. And the reason is because, as Andy Stanley once said, vision leaks, that there is this process. And more than that, but oftentimes people can't receive the vision that we're casting because we cast it in a way where we talk mostly about obedience and not about life. So I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine who's a church leader here in Los Angeles. This is about this yesterday. You see, Jesus said in his own words, I am the way, the truth, and the life, right? And usually religious people, one of those words sticks out more than the other for religious people. In fact, the more religious you are, I can predict which of those three words you're going to like the most. And just out of curiosity, which one do you think it is?
I'm going to say two.
Okay, right. Go ahead, say two.
Two.
Oh,
what?
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you got it. Yeah, truth, right?
Yes.
Yeah, they love the truth. Man, that is their word. Like people who
it's
were
golden.
Raised in the church. Oh, it's amazing. We love it. Now, the challenge with that word is this one. First of all, that's not the only word Jesus says that he was, but that's a favorite word to say that he is. And to a culture, like a post-Christian culture, that is searching desperately for God, but for a variety of reasons has decided that the church is not the place to discover God. When we preach the truth, what we do is we create a moment where they are put in a position to have to argue with us in order for us to be in relationship with us. We do that even with people in our own churches. So leaders oftentimes say, well, it's the truth. Well, you know, be a part of a small group because it's obedience. It's what God wants for your life, and to follow Jesus is to obey him. But what we tend to do is we tend to forget that, oh, sure, obedience has its place in the lexicon of spiritual maturity. But, like, can you imagine if husbands use that as their modus operandi with their wives? And, of course, there are husbands who do that with their wives, and they're called jerks, right? So, right? He's like, well, you will obey me. It's like, yeah, fella, give that a whirl and see how it goes, you know? And it's not going to work very well because God is a romance. He isn't just a hierarchical relationship. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's calling us to be co-creators with him. And so even with vision, pastors unintentionally come at vision as an obedience thing rather than a rocket ride. rather than a roller coaster, rather than an adventure. You know, the more I dream of the day when every spiritual leader understands that to follow God is to go on an adventure and to invite people into that, even if them being a part of God's adventure doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be a part of your adventure. And as soon as pastors start calling people more towards the adventure of following God versus the obedience of building their institution, then the irony is their institution starts to grow faster. Now, that was a long first answer. I've got another one, but I want to pause, Joe, in case you want to move the conversation in a different direction.
No, you can finish your thought on that. You write quite a bit about it, and what you just mentioned kind of got me thinking about what you had to say just about knowledge, that people do have a knowledge of God. A lot of people can have a great knowledge of who God is, but until you take a risk and get into a relationship with him, you're not going to see the power that knowledge can provide.
Yeah, and that plays out. I mean, the people who give the best dating advice are single. Mm-hmm. As soon as you get into a dating relationship, you don't know what's going on. You know, the people who give the best
parenting advice
yeah.
too.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, the people who give the best parenting advice are people who have never had children. And that's because, you know, I've read 5 children's books or, you know, parenting books, and so that makes me an expert on parenting. And then you get into it, and that's the good stuff. You know, I don't want to talk to a person that's never parented about parenting. I want to talk to a person who's raised 3 generations or 90 years old. They can tell me about parenting. And that's what God is calling us into. It's he's calling us into maturation, which is the very thing that we don't want to do, which actually dovetails nicely into the second reason that pastors don't experience more of this in their communities, or the greatest leadership challenge. So I mentioned earlier that mostly what I do these days is executive coaching. I work with high-performing leaders, high-performing teams, my business partner and I, and we have a ball doing it. And what we do really is help leaders increase their leadership pain tolerance and help create communities and teams that have an increased pain tolerance. And what we've discovered is that leadership is a lot like an athletic sport. You know, so in any athletic sport, there's things that are going to keep you from improving. Like there's competency, there's skill set. But really the thing that keeps you from improving more than anything else is your pain tolerance, your ability to push yourself past the limit of what you've decided is possible for you. And just like it's that way in sports, it's that way in leadership. But imagine if, you know, to the leader listening to your program, imagine if your leadership pain tolerance was greater, how much more you could lead, how much more you could grow. Because the reason why leaders don't grow is because growth is painful. And our pain tolerance stops us from having the conversations that really help us grow, stops us from moving into areas from competency to incompetency so that we can grow new competencies. And it's the same with teams. Like every leader in every organization, every system gravitates towards the way of least resistance. And that's what great leadership does, is breaks through that.
Well, it is definitely more comfortable to stay where we are, but of course that doesn't get us where we want to go. We're going to talk a little bit more about that when we come up after the break with author and speaker, trainer, Jason Jagard. He's written a book called Spark. We'll talk more about what it means to have that spark and how you can get it going if you are a leader or if you want to be led by someone and need that spark as well. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith.
Yo.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I love that song. It makes me want to get up and start dancing around. Thanks for choosing that, Ryan. Well, today we're talking with author Jason Jagard. He has written a great book called Spark, Transform Your World, One Small Risk at a Time, and has also created something called Spark Groups, which is an experience that has set thousands of people on a new course in life. So if you're looking to do that, you might want to get your hands on one of these books. We have just a couple left. You can give us a call at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. And also, we have some tickets to give away to a conference that Jason Jagard is coming to speak at here at University of Northwestern called Fuel. If you want to get your hands on some of those tickets, I highly recommend this conference. It's just a great spark, I would say, just for anyone who's a leader or engaged in leadership in their church or in their life or in their business. And if you want to learn more about that, you can go to myfaithradio.com, click on the Connecting Faith show page, and you'll find all of the information on that. So, Jason, we were talking a little bit about kind kind of stretching that muscle, and that will inspire you or give you a little catalyst to change. And I just kept thinking, I had this great conversation with my 13-year-old who got in my car after a workout. They're working out, kind of getting ready for the fall sports season, and he'd never really lifted weights before. And he's like, "Mom, I can't move my thighs. They hurt so bad." And I said, "Well, that's great, because tomorrow you get to go do it again." And he said, "I'm not doing it again. It hurts, and I just want to go lay on the couch." And I said, "No, no, no. Those are your muscles saying, I'm ready. I'm ready to grow."
Yeah, that's right. Well, and, you know, it's funny. So I live in Los Angeles, and so I'm a typical Angeleno. So various stages of the last year, I've worked with a personal trainer. And, of course, because you live in L.A., like, your personal trainer isn't just any personal trainer. He, like, had television shows on MTV and things like that. Such a fascinating guy. But so, you pay these trainers lots of money to work with you. And what's fascinating is when you pay a trainer, the next day after you work with your trainer, if you're not sore, you're actually angry.
Right.
Because you're paying, that's what you're paying money for. Like, I'm paying money for you to push me past my limits, because the evidence that you're doing that is that my muscles are sore. You know, so there's this idea of, like, bring it on. In fact, when I'm doing like bench pressing or leg presses or whatever, and I can't go any farther, my trainer will say, "You've earned only one more. You've only earned one more." And I'm like thinking, I don't want to do any more. But the way that he phrases that, is to say, like, remember, you want to push yourself. And by the way, to all the leaders who are listening to this, imagine in your families or in your organizations, if any time there was structural change, anytime people were experiencing any kind of normal, healthy pain in terms of leadership growth, instead of saying, "I'll make it stop," they would say, "Let's make this count." Mm-hmm. Like, instead of saying, like, "Take it away," they would say, "Bring it on." Mm-hmm. And that is a powerful leadership culture, where any kind of turbulence, they don't say, "Oh, I don't want to be a part of this." And that's the job of a leader. Like Max Dupree said, that the definition of leadership is defining reality. And a large part of that is defining pain and helping people understand that pain isn't either good or bad. It's a resource for us to leverage for us to become healthier, more inspiring human beings.
Well, and that's a great segue to what you kind of talked about with being in community and being in these groups. You wrote in your book about working out and that you were doing it alone and that someone was kind of watching and they're like, you're doing that wrong. And you found out that working out with a trainer, that must have kind of inspired you, that maybe you need people to kind of help you along. How does that kind of transfer into having a group and being in community?
Yeah, well, in my experience as a coach, most people's visions are too small. In fact, I have like an operational bias that says anytime I meet any leader and I say what your vision is, I can only say maybe one time out of 1,000 have I ever met somebody and their vision sounded like, "Oh, that's about right." Mm-hmm. It's almost always too small. And one of the even our own personal visions, like right now, Joe, if you're thinking about your vision for your life, or any listener, you think about your vision for your lives. And of course, I work with a coach, so my coach is asking me what's my vision for my life. And almost always, what they all have in common, other than being too small, is that they are things that we can do on our own. Hmm. And what God is calling, in fact, one of the evidences that the vision for your life isn't what God has for you, is that you can be done alone. Rarely does God call you into something that won't demand other people come alongside you in order for it to be accomplished. Because God cares just as much about who you're doing it with as what you're doing it with. And that's what I love. So that's why we created these groups. I mean, years ago, it's funny to talk about it now. Years ago, we created these groups that you can actually go to our website and we have content for free. Like, this isn't like a business for us. Like, we just give it away on how to start these groups where you actually take risks. So they're individual risks, but you're taking risks in the context of community. And when we started that years ago, it's just been phenomenal watching the stories that have come out of that.
Well, and I loved that reading in your book, you said, you know, we don't provide a lot of curriculum. We provide a place to start. You are the curriculum. Talk more about that and what that means in a Spark group.
Jill, thanks for asking that question. Not often, most of our work, like we've worked with, like our clients involve NBC, Chick-fil-A, and we have to work with like really fantastic companies. Right now, 60% of my clients actually are outside the country. Like, I do executive coaching with a lot of Australian entrepreneurs and businessmen right now. And so I don't get to work with churches as much as I used to. And I love it. Like, I'm very active in my church. I'm on the teaching team. I'm part of a church plant in North Hollywood. And so whenever we work with church leaders, we do a pie chart. Like, we talk about like small groups or really any kind of group. When we talk about, if you draw a pie chart and you say, okay, there's two things in terms of a process that happens in a community group, a small group, even a church service on Sundays or a leadership team. There's information and there's application. So the information is the absorption. This is kind of how the interview started. There's the absorption of information, and then there's actually doing the hard work of applying the information, because absorbing information is really easy. And so then we ask leaders, we say, okay, of a small group experience, what percent is information and what percent is application? And that's when everyone gets real nervous. Mm. And they usually they're like, well, it's like 80% information, 20% application. Some people are like 9% information, 10% application. Some people laugh and they're like, it's like 0% application. It's all information. In fact, some of your listeners I know probably have been a part of Bible studies and Bible groups and community groups. And there, I used to write professionally community group material, small group material, worked with Lifeway Publishing, and that was a great experience for me. And we were forced to write an application part, like that's part of the content, you know, but that's always the part that people ignore. So you have all this fun on the front end talking about the information and speculating and talking about it and thinking about how it applies to your life, but there's no time of actually applying it to your life. Mm. And we thought that was a massive problem, and we think that it's not a coincidence that the biggest indictment against the church from a post-Christian culture is hypocrisy, when we've structured hypocrisy into our educational environments. Hmm. We have shamelessly say information intake is 10 times more important, 100 times more important than application output. And so with Spark Groups, we inverted that process. So we said, hey, it's going to be 90% application and 10% information. And what's funny about that is people who have never been to church before love it. They love it. They love it the same way a person loves going to therapy or going to a 12-step program, because they're going to places to change. They're going to places to grow. What we've experienced is religious people hate it because they're looking for the content. They're looking for the cute, you know, quote they never heard of that they can tweet about later or put on their Instagram. Like, they're looking for the thing that they can absorb, not the thing that they can apply, because in the church anyway, our absorption muscles are huge and our application muscles are severely atrophied.
Hmm. You know, I remember very distinctly having a conversation with Sam Said's son, who loves math. And he had this just amazing teacher in fifth grade, Mr. Conkle. Shout out to Mr. Conkle. Thank you. And Mr. Conkle taught him to take all of this math, and he would come up with how you might use it to figure out statistics in baseball, or how much weight a person could lift if they were a certain weight, what the growth rate might be if they are jumping hurdles or something like that. And that year was this year of explosion for an interest in, oh, this is what I use math for.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden he was excited and he wanted to be a math teacher. And my husband and I will often comment on that when we come home from church and 4 days later we're saying, can you believe what we learned on Sunday? I'm still thinking about what I'm supposed to do today. You know, we were issued a challenge and we're still thinking about it several days later, not just what we learned, but what we're supposed to do about what we learned. And that's the mark, I think, of a great message or a great lecture or a great conference, that someone actually gave me information and then said, okay, now you need to do something with this. Here's what you can do. And that seems to be the disconnect sometimes.
I love that. Yeah, it is a disconnect, and it's an institutionalized one, even in the way that we train speakers, like preachers. So preachers, in order to learn how to preach, they go away to seminary and they take classes on how to preach rather than actually speaking. Right? And this actually gets into a very in-depth conversation, which we don't have time for today, but around spiritual gifts. Hmm. Now, a lot of people, the evidence of a spiritual gift is that people's lives change when you express it. By the way, that's the only evidence. The only evidence of the spiritual gift. You know God is at work, not when a person's competent at it, but when there's actual life change. And I use respectfully Billy Graham as an example. Like Billy Graham, if you let 20-somethings listen to Billy Graham as a speaker, he was not that charismatic of a speaker. But somehow when he spoke, 50,000 people in an arena would change their lives forever. Hmm. Right? And you can contrast that with communicators today, who can give the best talks and they're funny and they're charismatic and it's hilarious and it's emotional. And at the end, nobody's life changed. And so, like, the spiritual gift of teaching has nothing to do with competency. It has everything to do with life change. And by the way, for leaders, imagine the day when you have people coming to your church not to be entertained, although I love entertaining speakers, and I'm a pro, like, if you're looking at, like, church models, like the attractional model. I mean, I was on staff at Mosaic, and everyone McManus I think, one of the greatest communicators of the 20th century. And by the way, he's both competent in speaking. He's a world-class communicator, whether you believe in Jesus or not. But he also has the spiritual gift of evangelism. So Easter, just to brag about him for a second, last Easter, there's about 5,000 people in attendance at Mosaic, and 1,000 of them decided to follow Jesus. Now, can you imagine what it would be like if you give a talk on one Sunday and 20% of the people, part of your community, decide to follow Jesus? That's crazy. And that's the spiritual gift of evangelism, partnered with the spiritual gift of teaching, which everyone has both of those. But we tend to measure, in the church, we have secularized the movement, and we tend to measure talent versus spiritual giftedness. We tend to measure how likable a person is versus when they do things, does God move? And I think those things are all connected. The more we start risking, the more we start valuing application, the less addictive information will become to it.
I remember Andy Stanley saying once, who also great communicator, good at kind of wrapping up his sermon at the end and issuing some sort of a here's what you do with it. And he said something about, wouldn't it be great if the next time you were checking out at the counter, you smiled at the clerk?
Yeah.
And it was the simplest thing. So, so simple. But he made another comment and said, now, you're all thinking about, you know, what you're going to do when you go have lunch after church or something. But I'm going to give you one more challenge. What would it be like if you smiled at the person next to you driving out of the parking lot? And then everybody just laughed because you know that getting out of the church parking lot is one of the worst experiences in the world if people are, you know, trying to get to where they're going to lunch. So it was just kind of funny where we don't think about those really little things that can make a huge impact in our lives and in the lives of other people.
Yeah, that's true. And that's a good and Andy's a genius. And that's a really good segue just into the idea that risks don't always have to be big. You know, and I would rather create a culture where everyone is taking small risks than where people aren't taking any risks. And then to contrast that, though, I mean, and Andy's a great model of this. He's not afraid as a leader to call people to great risk as well as small risk. Like even one of his colleagues at North Point, Jeff Henderson. Jeff Henderson used to be a bigwig. I think he was at Chick-fil-A. Maybe he was at Nike or something. He was this huge leader there. And Andy wasn't afraid to call that guy to leave his business and to work for a 501c3 nonprofit, I'm sure take a salary hit. And now Jeff Henderson starts churches and grows into 5,000 almost on accident. Now, he probably wouldn't agree with that. He works really hard. But, you know, he left his business. He started this church. He's a businessman, grows a church to 5,000. And then he, like, gets bored. And he's like, hey, I'm going to go back to the business world. I feel like maybe that was my arc. And Andy's like, no. Like, don't go back to the business world. Can you do it again in another city? And Jeff, like, talks to his family, like, I think so. So they move, and now he's doing it again. Mm-hmm. And it's both of those, like, yes, smile when you leave the parking lot, and don't be afraid to quit your job to do something completely different and new and beautiful with your life. And if we can create cultures that promote both of those, then I think we're on to something.
Well, I'm talking to Jason Jagard today. He's written a great book called Spark, Transform Your World, One Small Risk at a Time. So we've been talking about taking a risk, whether it's big or small. And when we come back from this break, I'd love to talk a little bit, Jason, about what happens when maybe that risk doesn't go so well. There might be a little bit of failure. How do we recoup that and get right back on that taking a risk bandwagon? We'll be right back on Connecting Faith. Talking about giving it all we have, what if we took those gifts that we've been given and gave all we had so that people's lives were actually changed and Christ in us changed something in another person? Talking with Jason Jagard today, who wrote a book called Spark, Transform Your World, One Risk at a Time, but also is the CEO and founder of Spark Good, which is a company that's passionate about not only unleashing the creative potential in individuals, but also in organizations, in people one-on-one, and through these Spark groups that we've been talking about. So, Jason, one of the things that you write about in your book and is just the concept of failure. Every time there's a risk, of course, there's a risk of failing, and everything can't possibly be good. What happens when something doesn't succeed the way that you had hoped or thought it might?
Yeah, that's a great question. And most people don't realize this, but when Fortune 500 CEOs are interviewing high-level executives for new positions that never worked in the company before, one of the questions they always ask is, tell me about your greatest failure. Now, most of us would be nervous to answer that question because you're in a job interview, and the whole point of a job interview is to make you look good. But what most of us don't realize is that how you deal with failure is one of the most defining attributes of the trajectory for your destiny. You see, a Fortune 500 CEO is going to ask that question because if you cannot answer that question, they won't hire you. Because one of two things are true. Either A, you're not willing to admit that you have failure, which is a failure in and of itself, or B, is because your first gigantic failure is going to be on their watch. and they would prefer to avoid that too. And also not because of the failure is bad, but because they don't know how you're going to handle it. And just like I can point to times of greatest growth in your life will be around greatest risk, but I can also assume that your greatest growth in life, your greatest intimacy with God was around your biggest failures. And the reality is God does not look at failure the same way that we do. He relishes the moments in our lives when things aren't going the way we thought that they would, because it's in those moments that we have to grow and lean on him in new ways. In fact, if you look at the heroes of the scriptures, the one thing they all have in common is that they failed. Even from a narrative perspective, even Jesus, when he was executed on a Roman cross, it was a great defeat, right? And then, but that defeat turned into his greatest triumph. You know, Peter had anger issues, and he was an anti-Semite until like half of, or I'm sorry, he was a racist, not anti, he was Jewish, but he was anti-Gentile until like halfway through the book of Acts. You know, of course, Paul was a terrorist for most of his life until he met Jesus, and so. It's not only that failure wasn't a disqualifier for following him or being a huge part of the movement. It's almost as if failure is a prerequisite for being a part of the movement of Jesus. Most of the people who follow Jesus who were defined in the scriptures were people who we would never allow to lead local churches. They were really bad people, but God had a different view. God would rather work with a passionately immoral person and point him in a healthy direction than a, quote, moral, apathetic person who he can't get to move at all. And that's really why I do what I do, both with executive coaching and with Spark, and why I wrote the book, was to say, hey, look, it's better to be passionate, even though you'll make mistakes, than it is to be apathetic and feel good about yourself for how, like, clean or pure or righteous you are. I can't remember if it was St. Augustine or somebody else who said, maybe it was Luther, who was an alcoholic. You know, I mean, Luther was awesome. You have to be an alcoholic in order to stand up to the Pope. But he said, sin boldly, right? And this is the idea that God's grace is designed to create space for us to be passionately wrong so that we can learn to be passionately right. And the process by which we learn that is oftentimes through failure.
Well, and how do you really know what you're capable of doing until you figure out what you're incapable of doing by trying something?
That's right. That's right. In fact, Hank Fortner, who was a teaching pastor, or is at Mosaic, and he's doing this amazing program called Adopt a Getter. He one time told me, like, every person should have a good mental breakdown in their 20s. That way they know what they're capable of. Like, speed the dial out. Like, just get it over with. Just test your limits, and then see what, and then you can recover and go to therapy and all that good stuff. And then use your 30s and 40s and 50s as good decades for building. And most of us would, like, never give anybody that advice. But it's actually really great. Is this what you said, Joe, is it gives people an opportunity to test the extremities of what they're possible. And it demands, being at the extremity of what's possible for you, demands that you have a relationship with God in order to survive it. And I think that's where God wants to take us. He wants to take us into those extremities so that we can learn what it means to connect with him in a way that we never would, safe and sound in the center of our comfort zones.
Well, that reminds me of another part of your book I just loved, is when you were talking about Legos and that.
Yeah.
What a great opportunity Legos are to build something with what you have. It's not just figuring out, oh, these are my gifts, these are my strengths, and now I know what they are, but that you'd rather have Legos so you can build things. Talk a little bit more about that. Unpack that a bit.
Yeah, well, so I was a huge fan of Legos when I was a kid, and now I have nephews, and I was super excited to be the person who gave them the first Lego set. And so I bought some Legos and wrapped them up, and then I think it was Christmas, and we go to the house, and we're all opening things. And stupidly, I let my parents give my nephews a gift before me, and that was a rookie mistake. I haven't made that mistake since. And so my nephews pick up the package, and they shake it. And as soon as they shake the package, it's gigantic, this gigantic package. as soon as they shake the package, I knew what was inside. They didn't know because they didn't know what it was. So they rip open the package, and they, of course, it's this gigantic Star Wars Lego set, and they, like, get so excited. They're like, Legos! You know, my stomach just drops because I've got this, like, little set, you know, like, nothing. And so they're like, okay, you can go next, and they're laughing at me, and I hand them the thing, and they open it up. And I thought they were going to be, like, disappointed. You know, I thought they were going to be like, oh, we already have this. When they opened up the little package, they looked at me and their eyes got as big as dish plates, and they said, more Legos. The reality is you can never have too many Legos. Like, you can have too many iPhones. You can have too many Maseratis. You know, you can have too many houses, frankly. But you can't have too many Legos, because Legos aren't things that you preserve. They're things that you use. And our life experiences, our failures, the worst things we've ever done that maybe none of us have even, like, told people about, our greatest moments, our greatest triumphs, all of our, of course, our material assets, they're all Legos to build something meaningful. And I think God calls us to look at our lives like just a huge Lego set, and he says, what do you want to build? It's worth noticing that the question that Jesus asked people more than any other recorded in the scriptures is, what do you want? What do you want? What do you want? What do you want? What do you want to build? What do you want to create? What do you really want to do that's going to make the world a better place, or you a better person? And then let's go build that together.
Hmm. Well, I know that people are probably listening. They're like, I want to do that. I want to do that. How would they, maybe if they wanted to start their own Spark group, how would they get involved in doing that?
Yeah, you can always go to sparkgood.com. So sparkgood.com. If you click around there, if you click on groups and then click on Spark groups, you can sign up. There's free resources, there's PDFs, there's videos, and that's a great way to get to know that part of the company. There's a contact form there. You can reach out to me personally if you want. If this conversation has sparked something in you, that's no problem, and that's a great way to start.
And when you come to the conference, I know that you're going to be talking mainly to leaders, but really anyone is welcome to come because they may lead in their own way, right? When you're talking about leaders, you mean leadership in a broad way, correct?
Yeah. In fact, I get a little militant about anybody I meet who says they're not a leader. I've met fathers who say, oh, I'm not a leader. And I'm like, well, you have kids, right? Then then who's leading them? You know, so I'm a Maxwellian when it comes to the definition of leadership. You know, he famously defined leadership as influence. And if you have breath, before you're born, you have influence. Before you're even born, you're impacting the lives of your mom and your future, you know, your dad and the people around you. So I think people are born leaders. The question is how faithful are they to developing their leadership gifts? And obviously, this conference, I wouldn't be flying there. From Los Angeles. In fact, it's going to be crazy. I'm going to be working with a company up in Portland with my business partner, and then I'm going to fly out early to get to this conference. And I wouldn't be doing that if I didn't believe every person was designed to lead, even though they may not have, like, a quote, the spiritual gift of leadership, but they are responsible for stewarding whatever gift of leadership they have.
Mm. Well, I know that our students here at University of Northwestern will be very encouraged to hear that, and also just leaders from around our area as well. So thanks so much for doing that. And Jason, just thanks for sharing just your ideas about what it means to take a risk and how necessary that is just to have a spark that can get people started.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me on the show. I had a blast.
It was wonderful to have you here. And again, if you're interested in learning more about the Fuel Conference that's coming up at University of Northwestern, just go to myfaithradio.com. You have to go to the Connecting Faith show page in order to find that information and to enter in for those tickets. We're giving away several packs of tickets where you could bring three of your friends with you as well. Come enjoy the day, enjoy the campus, and we would love to see you here. Again, Jason Jagger, thanks so much. The book is called Spark, Transform Your World, One Small Risk at a Time. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.